Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with six race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Deadline for late summer registration is September 22nd. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, with the good fortune today to have with us as our analysts, Dennis Goldford, professor of political science at Drake University in our Des Moines studio. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, Ben.
Sarah Mitchell is with us in our Iowa City studio. She's the F. Wendell Miller Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Sarah, welcome back to you.
Thank you.
Getting acquainted more and more with Sarah. Sarah, you have expertise in international conflict, and we'll be asking for your analysis as we pursue some politics abroad in a few minutes. But first of all, I want to ask about the North Carolina special election. Yesterday, Dan Bishop narrowly winning this special House election in North Carolina. The president had endorsed Bishop, who defeated Dan McCready, a moderate Democrat, by about 2 percentage points. If we remember, it was last November, McCready narrowly lost to a different Republican, but that result was thrown out after evidence of election fraud. Let's listen to the winner here, the victor in this case, Republican Dan Bishop. President Trump held a rally in Fayetteville to help bolster his support on Monday. But here's Bishop during his victory speech.
Tonight, the voters of North Carolina sent a message that shouldn't just be heard within the confines of the 9th District. It should reverberate across this country and in the halls of the Capitol. The voters said no to the radical liberal policies being pushed by today's Democratic Party. Tonight was the first step toward taking back the House of Representatives in 2020 to keep this country on a path of prosperity and strength. Because under this president, America is great again.
The victor in yesterday's special election in North Carolina for this one House seat. Dennis, how do you see this as a bellwether?
Years ago, Lyndon Johnson used to say he wanted a one-handed economist. And people said, "What, Mr. President?" He said, "I want a one-handed economist." And they said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Every time I ask economists what should I do, they'll say, well, on the one hand, you can do this. On the other hand, you can do that." And this election produces, it requires several hands, so to speak.
Okay.
On the one hand, the Democratic candidate who was considered competitive lost, and close counts only in horseshoes and hand grenades, as the old saying goes. On the other hand, yes, he came very close in a very Democratic district, a very Republican district. So the good thing for Democrats is that he came very close. But again, on another hand, the problem is, at least according to some of the initial reports I've read, turnout was down somewhat for him. And that's always the Democrats' problem, because Republicans take voting more seriously than Democrats do, particularly Democrats who are single women, young people, and racial and sexual minorities. They just don't turn out as much. So it's perhaps comforting for Democrats that, again, they came so close, but again, they lost. They continue to have turnout problems. They're hoping 2020 turnout will be as good as or better than the 2018 turnout. And finally, you have a situation in which, again, we're seeing a division in the country between rural areas, which are increasingly Republican, starkly Republican, urban areas, increasingly Democratic. The danger for Republicans is the suburban areas, particularly with a lot of women, may tend to tip toward the Democrats. So that's why you need all these hands to understand this special election.
Sarah Mitchell, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think it's not the outcome is what we expected, essentially. It's a red state. Mm-hmm. It's a close election. We're seeing similar outcomes in Texas and Georgia. So I think, yes, the positive is that Democrats are getting closer in these races, but I agree that they're going to need better strategies for improving turnout.
Mm-hmm. Dennis, did Trump's campaign rally backing this candidate, this nominee, make the difference?
Well, we don't know that specifically yet, but sure, that helps. I mean, remember, I've said before that President Trump, while claiming initially that he wants to be president of all Americans, has governed as president of his base rather than president of the country. And he loves the rallies. He loves the adulation. And the rallies do increase the enthusiasm, the intensity, the adoration of what we would consider that Trump base. And that had to have helped. Whether it made precisely the difference, we just don't know yet.
Mm-hmm. As a sidebar here at Monday's rally in North Carolina, Trump again joked that he would stay in office through 2026. So in this case, so he could be president when the U.S. hosts the World Cup. But he's made these comments continually all along. Dennis, what do you make of this? I guess when the president would be asked about him, he would say he's joking, but it seems to be more than a joke or not.
Well, it's concerning. Yes, he may well be joking, but remember, as we see in places all over the world where the system doesn't work very well, elections work only when the losers agree to lose. I mean, it was only with the election of 1800 when political parties had formed here and the Federalist Party led by Adams lost to, after it went to the House of Representatives, Thomas Jefferson, the Democratic Republican Party, as it was called then, and the Federalists essentially agreed to lose. I mean, in countries where this doesn't work, the losers take to the hills and arm themselves. And so to joke about extending a term when it's clearly contrary to the constitutional or claim I may or may not recognize the results of the election, that's dangerous to the point of past inflammatory to sort of nuclear level danger.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it's not something to joke about.
Right. And we did limit the president to two terms following the Roosevelt administration. Right?
And that was famously called Republicans' revenge on Roosevelt. They wanted to make sure that no other president would be elected as many times as Franklin Roosevelt was, who was elected to the fourth term and 6 months later or so died in office. And the first thing they did when they recaptured the House and the Senate in 1946 was make a proposal for a constitutional amendment that was ratified as the 22nd Amendment, limiting the president to two terms.
Mm-hmm. Politics Wednesday with Dennis Goldford of Drake University, Sarah Mitchell of the University of Iowa. Let's move on to the other big news within the last 48 hours. Wow, it's been hitting us fast and heavy here in our political landscape. Let's talk about the National Security Advisor, John Bolton, out. President said he was fired. He fired Bolton. Bolton insisting he had resigned. Well, as is customary with this president, the announcement was made by Donald Trump via tweet. Here's the tweet. I informed John Bolton last night. This was yesterday. Yesterday morning, this tweet. I informed John Bolton last night that his services are no longer needed at the White House. I disagreed strongly with many of his suggestions, as did others in the administration. Well, yesterday at a White House press conference, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was questioned by reporters about the resignation of John Bolton. Here's what ensued.
So last night, the president asked for Ambassador Bolton's resignation. As I understand it, it was received this morning.
Was it because of the disagreement?
Go ahead. Yes, ma'am, in the back.
Go ahead, Terry.
Was it because of this disagreement? I'll leave to the president to talk about the reasons he made the decision. But I would say this. The president's entitled to the staff that he wants at any moment. This is a staff person who works directly for the president of the United States, and he should have people that he trusts and values and whose efforts and judgments benefit him in delivering American foreign policy. It's what, as cabinet member, Secretary Mnuchin and I try and do each and every day, and when the president makes a decision like this, he's well within his rights to do so.
Sarah Mitchell, let me turn to you. Can you look at the points of foreign policy over which the president and John Bolton disagreed? What do you think this is all about?
Well, I think they've had a series of disagreements. Bolton is a neoconservative, hawkish person, and so he's approached foreign policy from more of what we saw during the Bush administration in terms of being tough on Iran, being tough on North Korea. He disagreed with Pompeo and Trump on their decision to invite the Taliban to Camp David. That was significant, right, because the Taliban were the group that we went to war against initially in Afghanistan because they were basically hiding bin Laden, the architect of the 9/11 attacks. So you have to, so people reacted strongly to the situation because, in essence, you were inviting what is not officially a terrorist group in our country, but a lot of the members of its group have been declared as terrorists. And so Bolton was disagreeing with the president's decision to try to make that negotiation happen. I saw something about how Trump felt that Bolton was releasing things like the comment about whether we could use nuclear weapons to stop a hurricane. So I think there are a lot of
that Bolton could have been a leaker inside the White House.
Yes, I saw that this morning. So I think there's different theories about what exactly caused Trump to ask for his resignation at this point in time.
Mm-hmm. Dennis, what do you find interesting about this story?
Well, the president clearly knew what he was getting when he hired John Bolton. Bolton is well known as a hawk's hawk, essentially very aggressive regarding foreign policy, very open to the use of U.S. military force around the world. He was part of the so-called neoconservatives around George Bush, who said we make this world safe for American democracy by going out and trying to make the rest of the world democratic. And President Trump has sort of an older, almost paleoconservative notion of the world as essentially they're on their own, and we're just going to be Fortress America and worry about ourselves. So we see with Bolton, of course, that nobody outside of family more or less lasts very long in a Trump administration. And in some ways, you know, at the university level, we talk about having permanent faculty and adjunct faculty, people hired for a limited time for a particular job. This seems to be the adjunct administration when you have all these people in acting positions. Mm-hmm. And so we have another acting national security advisor. We'll see if somebody permanent actually comes along.
Right. And of course, the big question now is who will replace John Bolton. With the ejection of John Bolton, Sarah, can we say anything about how this shapes the foreign policy to come by this president? If he doesn't want this neoconservative foreign policy voice in his cabinet, what does it tell us?
Well, I think it tells us that we're going to continue to see countries like North Korea, you know, launching missiles and the U.S. not having a response. We heard that in the news segment.
Right. We had the president being quoted as saying he didn't like the way John Bolton offended North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un.
Exactly. So I think there's this tension. You have segments of the U.S. military who have views that align more closely to this neoconservative viewpoint that we're talking about. But on the other hand, you have segments of the Trump administration that are more, I don't know, it's hard to say if they're isolationist, but they're definitely not interested in starting new wars. And I think around the world, we're seeing a lot of countries become more revisionist with respect to their territorial claims. And that's something we'll talk about in a bit with Netanyahu. But you see, in terms of Russia's annexation of the Crimea, India's moves with respect to Kashmir, and now Netanyahu making advanced claims, you know, with respect to the West Bank. I think all of these are signs, right, that even democratic countries around the world think that they can be more aggressive with.
But this is a window of opportunity.
The positions and I think, that they want to pursue, and because they think that the United States is not going to respond.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about that now. Since you opened that door yesterday, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he would move to annex nearly a third of the occupied West Bank, the so-called Jordan Valley, if he wins election next week. Netanyahu citing Trump's support in announcing this move. And if you look at the map, which I got out the map because I'm not terribly acquainted with this part of the world, but it really, what does it do, Sarah? If you annex that Jordan Valley, it makes, it encircles the Palestinian, any future Palestinian state with Israel, right?
Well, essentially, we already have that situation in the Gaza Strip. And so if they annex territory in the West Bank as well, then you're right, there's a further enclosure of the Palestinian people. It also undermines the idea of the two-state solution because the settlers, the Israeli settlers in this area of the West Bank, there's always been a question about what would happen to the settlers if there was a two-state solution and the Palestinians took territorial control of that area. And Netanyahu is changing the status quo here by saying that he is going to make that territory Israeli territory. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. we've seen similar moves with respect to the Golan Heights in the last few months. So Israel has taken a stronger position with respect to its claims over that area. And again, that's upsetting the status quo because we had a UN peacekeeping force there since the Six-Day War. And so now, again, Israel is basically making a series of moves to expand its claims to these territories that have, for the last few decades, been in a more what I'll call neutral bargaining position.
Dennis, how do you see Benjamin Netanyahu's campaign promise here?
I think he's fighting for his political life, and just the way President Trump has this hardcore base of maybe 25% of the electorate, the people he said he could shoot somebody in Fifth Avenue and never lose a single vote. So I call these folks Fifth Avenue Republicans. Netanyahu has that base of support, particularly in the settler movement. It's one thing to argue that you control certain territory like the Golan Heights for strategic and military reasons, because if you've ever been by there, you can set up artillery on those heights and just rain artillery down into Israel. So militarily, there's a good strategic argument for control of that. That's understandable, that the military and strategic argument, but the settlers to some extent have almost a religious argument. They believe this is land given to them by God. And that's a lot harder nut to crack when you're trying to find some way to compromise. But at this point, Netanyahu seems to be pulling out all the stops in order to remain in office.
Mm-hmm. What about this point, Dennis, that Sarah made? We know most of the world, we have to remind ourselves, most of the world considers the occupied territory and Israeli settlements or annexations there to be illegal. This was part of this territory was gained in the 1967 Arab-Israeli war. Have we changed? Is the context different now so that, Crimea countries may feel like they can go for some territory that would have been off limits, decidedly off limits just a few years ago?
Well, I believe someone, and I can't remember the name, I'm sure Sarah would know, I believe someone once said the U.S. was the essential nation. And under President Trump, there's been there's a kind of vacuum of leadership. I mean, the Trump people can say all they want. The U.S. is respected around the world more than ever. I'm not sure if that's the case, but in particular, just as business people in this country value stability and predictability, so at the international level, allies and adversaries value stability and predictability. And the Trump foreign policy, such as it is, isn't giving them that. And that's why Angela Merkel and some others have said, we may be more responsible now for our own fate than we have been in the past, because they just evidently, by all reports, don't believe they can trust U.S. stability and predictability as much as they used to.
Or just a less, Sarah Mitchell, less of an engagement worldwide in the U.S., a more hands-off approach. Is that what we're seeing?
Well, sometimes we talk about the hegemonic state being the international policeman. So in essence, if a country tries to do something that breaks the rules of international engagement, then you have this country that's going to punish or do something basically to respond. And so when you have a country like the United States that is the most powerful country in the world and it disengages, then it's not just countries like Russia or North Korea or Iran that become more revisionist. We also see conflicts between our allies. So we see Japan and South Korea, for example, ramping up conflicts over territorial claims over islands. We see, India and Pakistan having increased engagement over Kashmir. So I think the implications for the U.S. pulling back from its leadership affect not only states that we might have thought of as enemies, but also the behavior of our allies.
Interesting. Before we take a break, let me get your views on what happened or was to happen last weekend. It seems like several weeks ago with the speed of our news cycle. But among the points of contention between John Bolton and Donald Trump was the president's intention, called off by the president at the last minute, to bring Taliban leaders to Camp David, that presidential retreat last weekend, to finalize an accord. And this came was to come just days before the 18th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. Dennis, what do you make of the collapse of this secret summit, the announcement and the announcement of its collapse via Twitter?
Well, there are oftentimes good reasons for an attempted negotiation between adversaries to collapse. So that in itself, I don't think is that unusual. But we're not sure, again, who is running the show. The president claims to be the one who makes the decisions, but so often he apparently does so on the basis of whim or feeling or just what he likes to call his gut, which he believes leads to a smarter outcomes than any of the so-called experts. But, we've been involved in Afghanistan close to 18 years. You know, that took several months after 9/11 to get underway. They housed Osama bin Laden, gave him free entry and exit, and the plans for 9/11 were evidently hatched there. But think of how long the U.S. has been involved there, and there is a segment of the American public very tired of that. The question is, and the Russians found out in the 1970s, evidently Afghanistan is one of these countries you just can't conquer or not at a price you're willing to accept. And I think in the Trump administration, at some point, people are hoping, well, maybe we can just sort of negotiate our way out of this in a face-saving manner, which has echoes of what happened with North Vietnam in the mid-1970s.
Mm-hmm. Before the break, Sarah, we've got about a minute. President Trump has said now that the negotiations with the Taliban militant group are dead, in his words. Where do you see this? We are no closer to ending our involvement in Afghanistan, are we?
I think the problem is that we did not have the Afghanistan government involved in this round of in the last few weeks in this negotiation.
Right. How unusual was that? I mean, your ally in Afghanistan, you exclude.
And we're making the agreement made some concessions on behalf of the government that was not at the table. So that included things like the release of Taliban prisoners. It included adding the name Islamic to the state name, which harkens back right to the way that the Taliban
ruled. Islamic State of Afghanistan.
Yes.
Wow.
So as you might imagine, and the Afghani forces have lost 45,000, they've suffered 45,000 deaths since NATO withdrew in 2014. So the Afghan government is paying the costs of trying to maintain security, but they're not at the table to negotiate for what they want.
We'll pick up our conversation with political scientist Sarah Mitchell of the University of Iowa and Dennis Goldford of Drake University after a short break. After we come back, we'll definitely get a comment from our guests about the so-called Sharpie Gates, implications there. Brexit, and also the next Democratic debate is tomorrow. 10 candidates on one stage, one night. We'll hear what they have to say in just a moment. I'm Ben Kiefer.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Deadline for late summer registration is September 22nd. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
So glad you're on board on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program, we'll listen to my conversation, actually from last night, with Van Jones before an audience at Hanscher Auditorium in Iowa City. Jones, a news commentator, an advocate for social justice, also a New York Times bestselling author, and he served as President Obama's special advisor for green jobs. That conversation took place last night before an audience at Hanscher Auditorium. Excerpts from that conversation tomorrow on this program. Today, it's a Politics Wednesday edition of our program. Sarah Mitchell of the University of Iowa, Dennis Goldford of Drake University, our political scientists, as we work our way through far too many topics to get to in an hour on the political landscape. Let me ask you briefly about this, what's been dubbed Sharpie Gate, to briefly recount. It has so many twists and turns in it, went on far longer than most of us would agree it should have. Back on Sunday, the 1st of September, 10 days ago, the president tweeting about Dorian threatening Alabama and apparently relying on information that was several days old at that point. National Weather Service forecasters working in Birmingham, the office there, were having a quiet morning when the phone suddenly lit up. Concerned residents. They didn't think they were being targeted by Dorian. They then issued a tweet, the National Weather Service, saying Alabama wasn't at risk. Then the president insisted he had been accurate, going so far as to display in the Oval Office a map that had been altered with a Sharpie to show, or some kind of pen, to show Dorian's cone extending to Alabama. We get to this week, Monday. The New York Times reporting the U.S. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross called the head of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, goes by the acronym NOAA, warned that heads would roll unless the disagreement with Trump was smoothed over. Dennis, sorry for that lengthy recap, but it's so involved. What do you make of it?
Well, when you look particularly at the map with the Sharpie, you just have to say, are you kidding me? I mean, that is so obviously an attempt to doctor the map. And yet there are people, I think, who will believe him. And the president, of course, if you listen to the words he uses quite often, I mean, he often refers to women as nasty or disgusting or things like that. He also uses the words strong, strength, strongly quite often. And this is a president who apparently believes that any admission of mistake is a sign of weakness, and you never do that. So instead of saying, well, you know, remember Rick Perry in that one debate, oops, you know, it went down in history, but, you know, he says, oops, I just happened to forget that point. And we joke about it at times, but people moved on. But the president belabors this because evidently he believes if there's just one admission of a mistake, the whole crystal shatters. And so there's this attempt to double down and quadruple down and whatever the next power, the 8th or the 16th, down even further, because he simply refuses to admit, as we all have to at times, admit a mistake.
What do you take away from Sharpie Gate, Sarah Mitchell?
Well, I think, first of all, when you have an agency or a department like the Commerce Department saying that employees cannot say something differently than the president, you know, that's clearly a violation of democratic norms. You have to be able to have free speech in a democratic country. Secondly, I think if you start to question agencies like the National Weather Service and NOAA, it's really problematic because the United States is one of the top three countries in the world in terms of frequency of natural disasters, and these are increasing over time. And so we are going to have even more natural disasters in the future, like these hurricanes. And if we start to question the information that's coming from these agencies, you know, we're going to have a problem in terms of how we manage evacuation of these areas. And so it's really imperative that we have faith in these institutions that monitor our weather and these disasters that strike the United States.
Let's jump abroad again. Today in the UK, a Scottish court ruling that the Prime Minister of the UK, Boris Johnson's suspension of the British Parliament was unlawful, prompting immediate calls for lawmakers to return to work as the government and the Parliament battle over the future of Brexit. 7 weeks to go until the deadline. The government and Parliament locked in a conflict over the future of Brexit. Let's listen to the UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson. September 5th, he was giving a speech at the British at a British police station when a reporter questioned him on the possibility of another Brexit delay.
Can you make a promise today to the British public that you will not go back to Brussels and ask for another delay to Brexit?
Yes.
And sorry.
I can.
And would you
I'd rather be dead in a ditch.
So you would resign first, Prime Minister, rather than go and ask for that delay?
It costs £1 billion a month. It achieves absolutely nothing. What on earth is the point of a further delay? If I understood you correctly, you just said that the Leader of the Opposition says he cannot trust me to hold an election before Brexit. Right. Well, I said about five times in Parliament. How many times I have to say it? We want an election on October the 15th. October the 15th. And indeed.
Okay, Sarah Mitchell, let me turn to you. What do you make of where Brexit is now? Will there be a deal to have Britain exit or crash out of the EU, as is often predicted?
Well, I think this is unusual because Johnson's using the prorogue, which is essentially an old practice in the UK where the Queen could suspend Parliament by sending agents. And it was very interesting. I was reading that the opposition party tried to prevent the head of Parliament from standing because I guess 400 years ago, this is how they tried to prevent Charles I from suspending the
really?
Parliament.
Okay.
So I thought that was pretty funny. So the reason that this is significant politically is because without Parliament being in session, then the opposition won't have a chance to try to influence how these Brexit negotiations are going or how they're going to handle them. And so it's a pretty bold move, I think. And the chances now that Britain comes crashing out of the EU is extremely high.
Mm-hmm. It's been interesting to watch because, of course, Britain has a parliamentary system, unlike our system. Dennis, what are you finding interesting about the Brexit story at this point?
Well, number one, at least I find it tremendously confusing. And part of the difficulty in understanding what's happening is, of course, that the British don't have a written constitution the way we do. When there's reference made to the British constitution, they mean the term constitution in the sense that we talk about the political system. But there are various norms in accordance with which things are conducted of the sorts that Sarah mentioned. But it seems to me that to the extent that Boris Johnson is a serious person, and there's some folks in Britain who doubt that he's really fundamentally a serious person, but to the extent that he is, Brexit is his signature issue the way the wall on the southern border is Donald Trump's signature issue. And just as President Trump believes he absolutely must make the case, whether it's true or not, to his supporters that, yes, the wall is going up because that was his signature promise, Boris Johnson has to make the case that yes, we are going to have Brexit. If you have two bodies that are conjoined to a great extent, ripping them apart, pardon the graphicness, leaves a lot of blood. Well, that's what would happen, of course, if there's this crashing out of Brexit with Great Britain in commercial and trade terms. And so, Johnson doesn't keep this promise, as devastating as some people think it might be, then he looks as though he's gone back on that signature issue. And if he ends up negotiating something, that's why they ask him about asking for a moving the deadline, he looks like Theresa May, which he doesn't want to do, the prime minister he replaced.
Dennis Goldford is with us on this Politics Wednesday, professor of political science at Drake University. Sarah Mitchell, political scientist, a professor of political science at the University of Iowa. About 10 minutes, a little over 10 minutes. Let's talk about tomorrow in Houston, the top polling candidates in the 2020 Democratic presidential primary facing each other on a debate stage. The third Democratic primary debate in Texas, in Houston, lasting 3 hours. Only 10 candidates, even though there are 20 candidates still currently running. Many of the primary's front runners will be there, all of them. Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, Pete Buttigieg will all be there. I want to get your thoughts on where we are now with 20 candidates still in the game, 10 on this stage. Dennis, what will you be watching, especially in this smaller one-night event?
Well, of course, the one point that everybody's making, or at least looking to, is you'll, for the first time, I believe, have Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders on the same stage. And they're running, as the metaphor is, they're running in the same lane, and there's not room probably for both of them. So will they be mutually supportive as they were when they were appearing on different nights, or will one start to become more critical of the other, or both critical of each other? So that's something we want to see. You will have, again, particularly the lower tier people just attempting to make some sort of breakout statement, breakout move. Kamala Harris had won in the first debate, but she couldn't sustain it in the second debate, and she's sort of fallen back into the pack. And then the question is, do they go after Joe Biden as being insufficiently representative of today's Democratic Party? Or, again, do they concentrate more on, at this point, Warren and Sanders?
Mm-hmm. Sarah, what will you be watching?
I think it'll be interesting to see what the moderators focus on for issues, because I think we've seen, right, a recent extended debate on climate change issues. We've seen health care, gun control, immigration. These are all things that have come up in previous debates. So I'm really going to be interested to see how Stephanopoulos and the other moderators kind of craft the issues that they will have them talking about, because I think whether we will see differences, for example, between Warren and Sanders is going to depend to some extent on what issues they're talking about.
How do you evaluate the issues at this point? Climate change, gun control, health care, Sarah, do you see an order in those? Is it clear that voters are going to be putting one above the other or really placing a lot of emphasis on certain issues?
I think Democratic voters are generally sophisticated when it comes to issues. So a lot of people are not single issue voters. They tend to care about multiple issues. So I think that's why the Democratic debates are organized in a way that has a discussion of multiple issues. I would say gun control has been elevated recently because of events that have happened. I think healthcare is going to continue to be an important issue for the Democrats because it's, you know, the ACA is something that they were the architect of, and Biden is certainly running on the record, right, of the when he was in the Obama administration. So mm-hmm. So I would expect to see that issue continuing to be important.
Campaign, major campaign issues emerging for you, Dennis, in this group?
Well, I think in a broader sense, what's of concern to me and interest to me is that one of the major problematic areas or aspects of the American presidential nomination system through caucuses and primaries is that the people that show up for those are the most activist and especially the most ideologically committed activists in the party. So typically the problem is that you've got to appeal to a constituency, the primary and caucus constituency, who are much more purist in various issues, both on the Republican and Democratic sides. And the question is, as much as you hit the kinds of issues for the Democrats here that are greatest concern to them, whether it's climate change or health care and things like that, will they so lock themselves into issue positions that they're not going to be able to reach back out to that broader constituency of voters that you're going to need to win? Although part of the argument on the progressive side is that for them it's a base election and you don't need swing voters and their people are enough. That's the big debate in the Democratic Party now. The Biden argument is you've got to reach outside the Democratic cocoon to other people who are more independent. Mm-hmm. The progressives tend to argue, no, all you need is to activate those in the Democratic cocoon.
Mm-hmm. Well, to move over to the other side of the aisle, there are three long shot challengers taking on President Trump in the 2020 primaries. Another was added just a few days ago. They are actually going to face off in their own debate later this month, it seems. Former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld, former South Carolina Governor and Congressman Mark Sanford, and former Representative of Illinois Joe Walsh have been invited by the Business Insider to participate in a debate on September 24th. The president has derided these opponents, calling them the Three Stooges. He was invited to participate, to my knowledge, in the report that I read. He hasn't responded yet. Dennis, in what scenarios do these candidates have a chance, or I guess another way of putting it, why are they trying to run against Trump when he has really taken over the entire Republican Party, it seems?
Sure. I think that the best they can hope for is to give disaffected Republicans a place to go other than the alternatives of staying home or voting for a Democratic nominee. And if they can reveal to some extent a certain dissatisfaction with the president, and again, he has tremendously high numbers among Republicans, so they don't have a lot of room to work. But remember that in 1968, in March of 68, I guess it was, or February, Gene McCarthy did not beat Lyndon Johnson, if I recall accurately, in the New Hampshire primary, but but he scored enough of a substantial minority of voters that showed that Johnson's hold on the party was weaker than expected, and that's when Johnson decided to withdraw from the 1968 race. So yes, President Trump has tremendously high support from Republicans. What was initially a hostile takeover has turned into Donald Trump's party. But there are quite a number of people who are not comfortable with him in Republican ranks. This gives them a place to go if they so choose, even knowing that it's just a statement. It's not actually going to win the nomination for their candidate.
Add to this the news that Republican officials in four states, Arizona, Kansas, Nevada, South Carolina, have moved in recent days to abandon their nominating contests next year's. I don't know if either of you, Sarah, do you have any idea of how unusual it is for state party officials to just say, no, we're not going to have a nominating process, just to scrap it?
Well, I think in the long history of our country, it's not unusual for parties to be the deciders of who they're going to nominate.
But just not to have a nominating process, I guess.
But in more recent times, I would say it's probably unusual.
And Dennis, what do you see there?
Well, I agree. I mean, we moved most of our nomination mechanism to primaries and caucuses after the 1968 Democratic Convention. But here's a case where, you know, the president likes to talk about things being rigged. This, to some extent, rigs the Republican process in his behavior.
Mm-hmm.
In his favor.
In his favor.
Behavior, yes.
Okay. We have a few minutes left, and of course, this is the 18th anniversary of 9/11. Each of us have vivid memories of that day. Those of us who were alive, who were not very, very young, have extremely vivid memories of 9/11, 18 years ago. Also in the realm of politics, it's interesting to note that this coming election will have the first voters come of age who were born after 9/11. That makes us feel old, for one thing. But I'd just like to close this show with your reflections on 9/11, pertaining to politics or not. Sarah Mitchell, would you start us off?
Yes, my daughter was born in 2001, and I just moved her to college. So
you've got a good marker there.
So she is the students now that I will be teaching in the classroom who were born when this really significant event happened. I think if you look at what I do, which is international relations, there was a major shift in how we study world politics after 9/11. We went from traditional models of world politics focused on great power competition and balance of power or hegemony, Cold War exchanges, things like that. And after 9/11, there was a real shift among political scientists to focus more on terrorism and counterinsurgency and civil wars and kind of reorienting the way that we thought about world politics. I think we're now seeing a kind of shift back to thinking more about great power competition. So perhaps 18 years later, we're returning to older ways of thinking about competition. I also think a lot of the legacies of 9/11 are still there in terms of, the Patriot Act, the TSA, you know, the Homeland Security. Like, these are all institutions that were created in response to that event, and those things are still in place today. So we're still feeling the legacies of 9/11, but I also feel, as an IR scholar, that there seems to be a kind of shift away from the discourse that was created around that event.
Dennis, finish up with some of your reflections on this anniversary.
Sure. Traditionally, when people would think of armed conflict, they'd make a distinction between being at the front, where the danger was, and then in the rear or behind the lines, where even military people on leave, but civilians could be generally safe. The purpose of terrorism is to erase that distinction, to make what should be the familiar, the comfortable, suspicious, and a concern about being dangerous. So it's not just when we try to get on an airplane, and of course we had hijackings since the late 1960s, so that changed air travel, but this really changed air travel. But aside from that, you know, this whole idea of see something, say something. If you're anywhere in public and you see a bag or a container that seems not to belong to anybody, it's just been left there, your immediate sense is to worry about that. In that sense, that's the goal of terrorism, to make everybody feel less safe. And unfortunately, to at least some extent, they succeeded in doing that.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. You make that remark about a year before 9/11, I had interviewed an Israeli writer, and the reason this stands out for me is one of my questions I remember was, what is it like to be in a state where you're always worried about terrorism? And of course, at that time, we were naive in thinking that we were protected from terrorism pre-9/11. And as you pointed out, Dennis, at that point, we lost that naivete.
We lost an innocence, yes.
We did. Well, thank you very much for this conversation. Dennis Goldford, Professor of Politics at Political Science at Drake University. Sarah Mitchell, the F. Wendell Miller Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Appreciate you both coming to our studios today.
You bet.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Rick Brewer, Caitlin Harrop, and Matt Alvarez. Also help today from Stephanie Nobriga. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.